Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzschrauber. On today's show, our bicentennial. It's hard to believe, but this is our 200th episode since launching the Tech Policy Podcast in January of 2016. So we're going to look back on the show, what went well, what didn't, talk about our recent policy summit, fairly recently, it was in July, and what's going on in the world of tech policy and how we can heal some of the divides and the wounds that seem to be festering over a variety of issues, whether it's, you know, Russia's meddling in the election or net neutrality or cybersecurity or take your pick. And there are a few better people to do a grab bag of tech policy issues with than our executive director, Austin Carson. So Austin, thanks for joining.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's becoming a regular thing a little late, but yeah, it's exciting.
That's exciting that, yes, almost a year after hiring you, you're now coming on the podcast. So, just thank you to all of you who listen to the show, who help keep us going. And thank you to those who came out to our inaugural policy summit. I'd like to think of that as kind of Tech Freedom's coming out party, Tech Freedom 2.0. And Austin, you know, how do you feel about all of the awesomeness that we do and just how awesome we are? Would you like to comment on how awesome we are?
Feels wrong. It feels like I should call my mom and tag her in and be like, just say this. This is fine. You're the only person that can do this without me blushing and feeling like an asshole. Also, I'm sorry I finished the sentence that way. It was really...
It's untoward of me. It's really cool, though. I mean, my mom listens to all the shows, too. And she's one of the only people that will give me honest feedback and be like, I didn't think that one was very interesting.
That's what the people you love are for, right? Yeah.
Everyone else is always like, oh, my God, it's just such a great show. I just love it. And I'm like, not sure you're being honest.
Right. My idiosyncrasies are like a glowing red light every time I listen to the show. And I understand that maybe it's fine, but don't lie to me. Don't tell me there's not something in my teeth when there is. It's not what you're here for.
No, exactly, right? So, you know, getting back to the summit, you know, it was really a way of just showing how we organize our work going forward. And I think it was really timely because it was a way of bringing people together, variety of backgrounds, variety of political views. And I got to be honest, like, the tech policy world is kind of scary these days, right? You know, it used to be the shining light, or shining city on a hill, to quote Reagan. You got to get your Reagan quote out early in the show. But, you know, the shining city on the hill where it's like no matter what it was, whether it was BP spilling oil into the ocean or whether it's like terrorism or like NSA surveillance, or it always just seemed like just the success of platforms and the cool shit that was coming out and like my phone's getting better and I have cool Netflix shows, it always seemed to kind of float above, right? It was always that cool thing. And it seemed bipartisan too. It seemed like no matter what, tech could do no wrong. Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, you were always like, yes, this is a bright spot in our economy. This is what's going well. Everything else sucks. And now it's like, no, screw tech. Y'all are too big. You have too much information. The reason the election went the way I didn't like it is because y'all didn't clean up your ads or whatever it is. And like, you come from the Hill. Like, that's right. Why we hired you, right?
It's the only reason.
Yeah, obviously. God, we have to put up with all your idiosyncrasies. Idiosyncrasies. I can't even say the word. I'm really good at this show.
200 times, guys.
Yeah, 200 episodes times. In and I can't speak English anymore. But for real, right? So you spent like 7 years on the Hill working for a variety of members. Did you sense this bubbling up? Did you see this coming? Or were you just witnessing the fluffy, like, yay, these companies are great. Every congressman wanted to take a picture with a tech CEO. Like, what did
I think? I think I saw, I saw the end of it, really. And actually, somebody who was at the conference shed light on this in a Facebook post, incidentally.
Funny.
In one of the best ways that I've seen anybody point it out, it was Rebecca Mark, who now works for Cruise Automation, which is developing the technology that GM is putting in their soon-to-be autonomous vehicles. And she said, you know, it's not, we thought of tech as like its own thing for a long time, right? It was like there were oil companies and there were auto manufacturers and there were, you know, people that made stuff that went in your house. Then there was tech, right? Tech was, for some people, internet companies. For some people, it was like the chip manufacturers. And for some people, it was your like server, Oracle people, or your internet infrastructure. But in some way, all of these things are their own monolith. But what we're finding as time goes on is that it's not that this is its own industry in as much as it is kind of taking things that we've always had in some context and always experienced and bolting magic on top of them, right? Like Amazon is retail 2.0 to some extent, right? Google is advertising 2.0, right? Facebook is your, like, all of your random interpersonal communications and your message boards and like just the poster board at your town center where you post a random thought or advertise.
Your GeoCities blog.
Right. In a way far more robust and interesting than Craigslist ultimately has been as classifieds, it is just like the grand centralization of intersocial communication or interpersonal communication. And so I think that as time goes on and we stop just being wowed by the raw magic of aggregating things and then pouring secret sauce on top of them and making them into something that's more useful or engaging. And especially as we start to criticize how that secret sauce has been formed and people are talking about, you know, oh, is this engagement model causing some problem with our dopamine systems? Are we ultimately happier to scroll through Instagram and find one thing that lights up the pleasure center than we are to look for any meaningful information? And so,
is it addictive, right?
Yeah, yeah, right, exactly. And so these, you know, we're engineering products in such a way that they are in a big data context demonstrably more stimulating to people, but does that mean that we're ultimately providing more value? And in some contexts, I think that we definitively are, in that you're getting new perspectives, your lives are more efficient, people that would have had to be dependent on others can now remain independent, people who would have had to lose contact with each other can now stay connected. And these are themes that we covered in some length leading up to the conference and at the conference. But ultimately, the real questions are going to come when we move past this raw magic phase and get into like the institutionalizing phase of it, where, you know, in the same way that General Electric and General Motors rose up as the grand, you know, carriers of like home and industrial products and vehicles, and, you know, your other massive titans of industry of a decade past arose, the same thing is starting to happen with your Googles and your Facebooks and your Apples and your Amazons.
And part of that's because they are now the most valuable companies, right? When you looked at the top 10 years ago, it was not the way it is now. It was ExxonMobil. It was General Electric. And now those companies seem to be being eclipsed, at least in terms of market cap. And that's not necessarily the best way to measure power. But it seems like they're the big dogs. And I forget what the acronym is, but Europe has an acronym for the big five. GAFA, right? It's Google, Amazon, or Apple, right? Facebook, Apple, or Amazon again.
Right. Whichever one you want it to be. I'm not sure how they organize things in Europe. I don't like it. It scares me. Very uncomfortable.
It's the whole Atlantic Ocean barrier thing. But is this just now a cycle, right? That when companies become successful, whether it was the oil industry with Standard Oil, whether it was steel with Andrew Carnegie, that eventually the scrutiny comes, eventually the antitrust hammer comes down.
To some extent.
You get regulated.
To some extent. And I think I mean, I'm just completely making things up right now, so I'm sorry.
That's what we do on the podcast, though. So, especially episode 200, when we're basically phoning it in.
Right. Just sorry, guys. Just phoning it in. I'm just drawing something on my notepad here. but ultimately, like, we're getting to this point where it's not so much just that they have become super prominent, and it's not that they're going to follow the same path, I think, necessarily as, like, the railroad operators and your, you know, earlier industrial titans. But you're seeing a totally different environment on a couple levels. First of all, if you don't read Ben Thompson's Stratechery, it is phenomenal. I really enjoy it. And he has a very interesting take on kind of categorizing some of these actors as aggregators and writing about aggregation theory, which involves like the zero transaction costs and the automation factors and how the network effects of these models and the data that they pull together are on one hand a strength, but on the other hand, add complications that we have never before had to deal with, both just as humans in general, but also from a regulatory perspective, from a societal perspective. And you know, you get some incredible benefits out of this, right? He just wrote a post about the Russia Facebook ads question that's arising right now as some senators are about to introduce some legislation. Klobuchar and Warner, which have great people on their staff, do great work.
Yeah, just so for context, we're recording this on Wednesday, October 4th, and the bill is supposed to drop tomorrow, Thursday, October 5th. And we actually just had a podcast with an FEC commissioner talking about this very issue.
Right. But one of the points, and there are like legitimate questions to be asked about like an automated zero transaction cost system, which on one hand enables niche actors to participate for the first time.
Like so tech freedom. We get our message out using those
Seriously.
Ads.
Yeah, exactly. In a way that allows us to find people who are interested that we would never expect are interested in the message, who want to talk about how, you know, the growth of technology can be accelerated and how we can ensure that we still are protecting the freedoms and individual liberties that we most hold dear and how those things can accentuate each other instead of damage each other, right? That's a message that I think is going to become increasingly meaningful, and it allows us to communicate in that way. At the same time, that same methodology means that if you're being discreet, you know, Russia drops $100,000, which in the grand scheme of the, you know, billions of dollars that are now spent on elections, doesn't seem like that big of a deal. But they're doing things in like a non-traditional, they're not running like vote for or against this guy, and they're not saying vote for or against this initiative or do or don't legalize pot or guns or abortion or whatever.
They're poking our buttons.
Right. And they are doing it super effectively. Now, the interesting thing is that this has been Russia's playbook for a long time. It is, they have always considered psychological warfare to be a keystone component of it. And because they have a somewhat grosser perspective on, I mean, from our perspective, a somewhat grosser angle on the acceptability of manipulating people emotionally for the sake of destabilizing their societies and governments, that is a platform that can be weaponized in that way. Now, the real question is, if we're going to take action against something that isn't transparently electioneering, that isn't transparently going to be impacting, you know, in the traditional way we think of political advocacy, you're going to come to a point where that zero transaction cost model, which enables a much greater freedom of expression, is put to task, and you put humans back in charge of verifying everything that happens, which means that you will no longer have the same degree of access. So, you know, this isn't something that's completely alien. You know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, there were similar issues that arose with the internet being connected and all of the networks being connected for the first time into the internet. And, you know, there's been in this article talks about what Microsoft dealt with and how they had to think about that and make scalable solutions to address it. And we have technologies that will allow us to sort and find these types of corrosive efforts by foreign actors who, you know, it's not just if they pay in rubles or not, or if they're writing in Russian somewhere, where it even originates from necessarily. It's about the content. So, you know, those are very difficult decisions in terms of how to address that problem that those companies have to make. Now, and I'm sorry I'm rambling, but I have one more point before we move on.
I'll eventually speak.
Yeah. Something that I think is also really important to consider is, holy shit, I totally lost my train of thought as I like stopped to apologize for being an asshole.
No, that's cool. So, no, I mean, I kind of wanted to, so yeah, obviously we could do a whole other show on the Russian stuff, which we did, but I kind of want to talk about just these companies as being large and powerful, right? Because that's an anxiety in and of itself. And,
right.
And that's what you've seen in other industries. Now, there's an argument to be made that the internet is the easiest place to start a business, that the United States internet economy is the best place to start. But now we're getting into this question of data sets, right? And I know it's a little immature to suggest that, oh my God, whoever has the most data is just winning, because as we had we're going to release a show about artificial intelligence, and it's what you do with the data and how you interpret it that matters too. But is there a sense that if companies just have the most data, their advertising powerhouses like Google and Facebook, is it really that easy to start a company now? Is it not that they are gatekeepers, that they can retaliate against their competitors? And you see this in the TV show on HBO, Silicon Valley, where Gavin Belson, who's like he's supposed to be, I don't know, Steve Jobs. You could say he's like any CEO, right?
Mm-hmm.
He has a lot of characteristics of some of these tech CEOs where anytime someone challenges him, he sues the shit out of them. He tries to buy them. He goes after them. And is that going to be a problem? Is it going to be a problem that we always have this cliche with the next Google, the next Facebook, the next Apple, the next Amazon? Is it really plausible to suggest that some upstart's going to come around and not necessarily take them out, but take them on?
So here's the beautiful thing about this. This kind of goes to, again, a key message in the conference and in our mission in general, which is that we can't anticipate what new technological developments are going to do to the ecosystem. And this morning, there was an article in, I believe, Axios's mainline publication about a new startup called, like, Light. It's not Lighthizer because that's the trade representative, but it's Light something, which is a company that at least comports to be able to, with limited data, do the same type of targeting and engagement work that companies with massive data sets could do, so that startups themselves will be able to have a similar degree of engagement that the big guys do. Because one of the main complaints that I hear as this whole Taplin Foer, the big guys are evil, their networks make them unstoppable, we have to figure out how to stop them thing is...
Yeah, Jonathan Taplin, he's a prominent critic of large tech companies, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he has a book out that he's been writing, and Frank Foer has a book that just came out as well that's got a similar thing about the impact on the mind. I mean, legitimately interesting and important things to consider on one hand, but the fact that they're being spun as like raw fear-mongering, stop the demon before he gets too big, is kind of crazy because... literally, I don't know, a year ago, we were all pretty excited about what having a bunch of information could teach us about ourselves and make us be able to develop, right? So I think in as much as we can take these concerns and these criticisms and the commentary about and the data about what behavioral engineering might be doing to people's minds as they're using these products, or about different concerns and and ask people to show, you know, not algorithmic transparency, show us under the hood, but let us know what you're thinking as you're developing these products. And also, you know, if the public becomes aware of it and they want a different model for content to consume, then both their behavior and the public statements will make that the case. So, you know, I think there's going to be some type of furor to regulate because people can't imagine something that would allow a smaller competitor to topple a Google or a Facebook or an Apple. But let's keep in mind that a decade ago, nobody thought that you could topple Microsoft.
Or MySpace.
There's right?
a great article that we ran on our social media called Will the MySpace Monopoly Ever Go Away or something like that, which it's funny, right? It's funny to post things like that because it shows that we don't know everything that's going to happen, that you can't always anticipate it. And let's remember, like, maybe part of it is that this moved so quickly, that it took much longer for oil companies, for appliance companies, for auto companies to become dominant.
Right.
Now we're talking about Uber's been around for like 7 years and it's dominant, right? Or Amazon's been around for 20 years and it's dominant. Same thing with Google, where just take a step back though and realize it's 20 years. It's not an eternity and we don't know what's going to come. But I got to say, I've worked at Tech Freedom 3.5 years. We talk about techno-optimism, that like most of the technology will be used for good. There will always be bad actors. And the way to deal with that is to deal with the bad actors without screwing over the people who do things for good. We talk about dynamism. We talk about the idea that you need to be comfortable with what you don't know. You need to be comfortable with the fact that there's going to be trial and error. Someone's going to get breached. Someone's going to screw up your privacy. Yet we can't always freak out when something bad happens. We have to allow the process to take place. We have to allow change to happen. We can't be afraid of it because then you become an enemy of the future, not a friend of the future. All that said, the environment doesn't seem to be very friendly to that kind of thinking right now. And how much can a think tank like ours, however scrappy we are, right? We like to think we're scrappy. We punch above our weight. But, you know, we're not 100,000 employees, right? How are we going to...
Jesus, 100,000 employees.
Can you imagine? That would be insane, right? Yeah.
Horrifying.
Yeah.
That many nerds in one building.
Message to our supporters, please increase. Yeah. So it's like, how much can we do? And not just us, right? There are others that feel this way, but are we headed for just a period of decline in the discussion around tech? Are we headed for a period of heavier regulation? Mm-hmm. It seems like there's populist elements in both the Democrat and Republican Party. You've got Bernie Sanders and you've got Steve Bannon. They agree that big tech needs to be broken up. So are we just headed for a bad time, or are there reasons to think that groups like ours and optimistic folks can turn down the temperature and come to some solutions, address real concerns without breaking it?
So first of all, we're headed for a bad time. if you,
and that's it. Thanks for listening, guys.
I mean, if you consider yourself a techno-optimist, if you generally enjoy the progress of technology and you think that the American internet companies and technology companies have wrought something generally decent and good upon society, I mean, I think that way, and I'm still a little bit like nonplussed by how certain platforms have made me enjoy my day less. Like I'll log on to watch, go through my newsfeed, and I'm like, man, this really illustrates how much I don't like people I thought I liked. I didn't know. Nobody told me, but now I know. But here's the real thing about
this, right?
There's
that data telling us things about ourselves you were talking about.
Right. So like my engagement is all time low. But what I do think is very interesting about that is like, that was always the case, right? Like the things that we're now knowing from those platforms and the things that we're having kind of revealed, like this isn't a problem so much in technology. Like we can blame behavioral psychology and we can talk about, you know, the power of these platforms and the data they're using. And to some of the earlier questions about like anti-competitive behavior in the case of a Gavin Belson, right? I mean, we aren't like a close your eyes and just say it's all going to be fine. I mean, we have always focused heavily, I mean, in the time I've been here, and I've been told it's always the case, but we have always focused heavily on the concept of consumer welfare and the consumer welfare standard, right? And I think that taking that out of like an FTC term and moving it into a more macro concept, it's about people having both agency and power and information to have more control over their lives, right? And I think that we need to be careful about turning away from the concept that we can do something to change it, or that we could take this idea of like bolting technology onto an existing concept and to kind of using that magic factor to create something new, as if it's over, as if, you know, we made Google and Facebook and Amazon and we're just going to regulate them like common carriers or break them up and we're just going to be fine with what we got. And I don't know, it's all just not the best anymore. So I look, in as much as It does seem a little bit dark out there, and that you do have people that are talking about breaking up big tech. On one hand, having the conversation itself with a bit of sobriety around it is a positive thing. It's a good thing for us to talk and analyze what it is that these aggregators and what massive network effects and what massive amounts of big data are doing for us. And I think that in as long as we don't get sucked into this being like a how and when do we break up big tech? You know what I mean?
Like it's like, an inevitability, right?
Right. Yeah. Like as though that this just that something is big and just something that has a big network is bad. Us aggregating a bunch of information about cancer is why we are getting closer and closer to curing cancer, and why the cancer survival rate is at an all-time high. Right? Aggregating information and using the power of network effects and algorithms and processing is injecting truth and finding patterns and information that is well beyond our capacity as humans to do without assistance. So I think that we're going to have to focus on, I mean, really kind of build out, you know, not to be Ted from How I Met Your Mother, but build out your pros and cons list. You know, we're going to ultimately build out what it is that this is adding to our lives, what it is that we're concerned about, and have honest conversations about it.
Yeah.
But the end of it is the honest conversation. And then going from there to elucidate what are legitimate harms. We don't just have some vague concept of what is and isn't good or bad, because moralizing without information is the surest path to doing something really absurd and insane.
That seems like Congress is really good at that. So I don't want to take
aren't
that.
We all,
I don't want to take that away from them. But yeah, if I could be a little sappy and anecdotal, part of why I'm optimistic is the people I've spoken to on this show. You know, this is the 200th episode, and I've had a few repeat guests, but for the most part, it's been a lot of voices, a lot of diversity, people from government, people from civil society, engineers, lawyers, generalists like myself, other people who host their own podcasts. And I got to say, I've learned more doing this show than doing most things in my life. People come on here, even if I disagree with them, we have an honest conversation. I think part of that is the format of a podcast allows for that. It's not a 3 to 5 minute television soundbite where the newscaster's trying to get me to say something ridiculous. It's not the floor of Congress where just you have to grandstand or you have to say something mean about your opponent. Really, the entire purpose of this show and what we're going to keep doing with this show is to give perspective to issues that are better explained in 20 to 30 minutes than in 1 minute or 140 characters.
Thank you.
And it's just, that makes me feel good to know that I spoke to so many people and they seem to be operating in good faith. And I think that if you remember that it takes a certain person to write a shitty comment online, or you read the comment section of a news article, ask yourself, how many times have I written a comment on a news article? And then you realize most people aren't doing it.
Right.
So maybe the assumption should be most people are operating in good faith, most people want what's good, and that yes, the internet, for good and for bad, allows the loudest voices, the shittiest voices to get out there, and they might get the most engagement, and the algorithm might reward them. Just remember, there are plenty of people that are just using it to post a photo of their baby, and that's adorable. So
yeah, okay, and I think that is actually the most important point, and thank you for bringing that home for me. But really, it is all about perspective at the end of the day. It is all about a combination of perspective and then information that you can use to validate between a number of perspectives. Because, you know, the person that is out in Silicon Valley, or the person that's the engineer working at a company, or the person that's in West Virginia that likes using Skype and Facebook to keep in touch with their relatives, or is suddenly going to have access to some type of autonomous vehicle bank that allows people that are immobile to stay mobile, or, you know, any place where you've got just a group of people who in their minds are doing something good, but may live a totally different life than people in middle America, or people in middle America who live a totally different life than people on the coasts, right? A lot of this is illustrating some of the divides that we don't have to confront on a daily basis. But that perspective of talking to people that we disagree with, coming from the viewpoint that you're probably not a bad person, you're probably just a bit different from me, and you probably were raised in a different environment and have lived in a different environment, whether that's people in DC who can be like night and day, or people all across the world, we have to keep in mind that until we are willing to openly evaluate these things with a unbiased mind, which is so rare these days, because we're rewarded both biochemically and socially for making a grandstanding point. You know, it's the politicians that stand up and speak truth to power, even though they're in power. Right.
Everyone else has market power except me.
Right. It's the Bernie Sanders that wants to spread it all around, even though he's got three houses. You know what I mean? It's that type of. I mean, it's not even. I mean, not that there was a story that broke today involving social issues or anything that was particularly gross. But this type of like hypocrisy and almost it's kind of hilarious because the social engineering that politicians largely accuse these companies of is something that they are unconsciously doing as a function of their like human wetware and hardware on a daily basis. It's this like emotional and social manipulation. So look, some of this is hardwired into us as people, and maybe having data and having something empirical is our opportunity to evaluate that honestly for the first time and for us to make a decision what type of life and what type of world we want to have.
I think that's a good way to wrap up. I would also like to add a final thought. Speaking of innovation and idiosyncrasy, in the process of recording this episode, Austin has torn a clothing tag into so many small pieces that I think eventually he'll keep ripping it up into smaller and smaller pieces and it will actually cease to exist. And I think that would be one of the most innovative things I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, it's so incredible. You can actually reduce matter to nothingness if you try hard enough. Sorry, guys. At least it wasn't a beer wrapper. It would have already been gone. It would have already disappeared into the ether.
I think that comment about reducing matter into nothingness is a perfect way to end this episode.
Left my fidget spinner at home.
Yeah, and if you have a podcast app that deletes things after you've listened to them, that's a form of reducing matter into nothingness. So we'll leave it there. Thank you for supporting this show. If you feel like you really enjoy it and you want to help us keep it going, go to techfreedom.org/donate. Or if you don't want to spend money, but because of big data, you can actually sell yourself to a charitable organization, go to givewithdata.com and just choose Tech Freedom, answer a few demographic questions, nothing too creepy, and we'll get like $5. So that's always fun. But, you know, thanks for supporting the show. Keep listening, and we hope to keep this going for another 100 episodes and then have a tricentennial. But my guest has been Executive Director of Tech Freedom, Austin Carson, and a very, very normal guy. Austin, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please write us a review because we'll help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.